Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome to the Interpreter Show on this, well, I don't know, maybe it's not this way for everywhere, but it's a drizzly, rainy Sunday evening for us here on the Wasatch Front. So, I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley, Spencer Marsh, Stephen Smoot, and joining us by phone is Hales Swift. And this is, that is you on the phone, right, Hales?
Yes, it is.
Excellent, excellent. I'm never sure until I've heard the sweet dulcet tones of his voice. This is a bittersweet episode here for us and for our crew here, because this is actually going to be the last episode where we have Stephen Smoot joining us here in studio. He's going to be off in Idaho for the rest of the summer, and then after that, he is going to be chasing a PhD out in Washington, D.C., Stephen, you want to tell us a little bit about the adventures you have coming up there?
Sure thing, Neil. I have decided very unwisely to forego gainful employment and having leisure time in my life to pursue a doctorate in Semitics and Egyptian languages and literature at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And that will be somewhere between a 4 to 5 year, at least 4 to 5 year program. And it's going to occupy pretty much all of my time and attention for the next half decade, basically. And I'm trying to apply myself as best I can. And so because of that, I must sadly bid adieu to the wonderful interpreter crew here. So, yes, this will be my last time, and we'll see what brighter pastures await.
And what exactly will you be studying in your program?
So, as I mentioned, the program is Semitic and Egyptian Languages and Literature, which basically covers a broad area of, the Hebrew Bible and cognate Semitic languages from Hebrew, Aramaic, Akkadian, Ugaritic, Arabic,
right.
And so forth. But it also covers other Afro-Asiatic languages, such as Egyptian, in its various stages. I will be studying Egyptian in its earlier and later iterations, so hieroglyphic, hieratic, demotic, Coptic, and so studying the different stages of Egyptian. It's a very language-heavy program,
mm-hmm.
So texts and philology is really going to be mainly what I'm studying in this program, not really so much on the archaeology side of things. And my particular area of interest that I'm going to pursue is going to be to do basically what you might call, quote, biblical Egyptology, end quote. That's a phrase that was coined recently by an Israeli Egyptologist who said that we should be taking the tools of Egyptology and applying them to studying especially the Hebrew Bible and analyzing the Hebrew Bible. You know, as I'm sure everybody here knows, Assyriologists and other experts in Mesopotamian history and culture, they will use the tools of Mesopotamian studies and apply to the Bible. And it's long overdue to do this more systematically with Egyptology, and I hope to do that. So I hope to look at, comparative cosmology, essentially. Looking at the worldview of the ancient Egyptians and comparing it with the biblical worldview and seeing what convergence and overlap there might be. So that's going to be sort of my emphasis or my area of study during my program, that will focus very heavily basically on language and texts.
Wonderful.
Are there any particular connections you're expecting to see or explore?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm going to explore, I'd like to explore, the creation cosmogonies, meaning the creation of the cosmos in a mythological sense, the creation cosmogonies of Egypt and Israel. So I want to look at Genesis, the creation account in Genesis chapter 1, and going into chapter 2, verse 4. And I want to do a comparative analysis with Egyptian cosmology and creation mythology to see if there's any converging overlaps. There have been some scholars in the past who have pointed to interesting parallels between how the Israelites imagined creation in Genesis 1 and how the Egyptians imagined creation, but there's been no systematic study. And so my preliminary plans for perhaps even a dissertation topic would be to do a systematic study of the creation account in Genesis 1 with ancient Egyptian creation accounts to see if we can detect any convergence in sort of, you might say, cosmological imagination or belief, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
Cool. Going along with that, we'll also be looking at possible routes of transmission of Egyptian ideas into Syria, Canaan, into biblical Israel. That's another field of study where people have said, okay, if we think that the biblical authors in some ways or in some cases are drawing on Egyptian material, how did that Egyptian material get there? So studying routes of transmission and things like that, that's something else that will sort of be associated with this, with my study. But that's kind of, broadly speaking, what I hope to look at.
Very cool.
Very interesting. So is the goal of your program to A, become rich and famous, B, to star in the next Indiana Jones film, or C, dwindle in intellectual obscurity studying pre-dry linguistics?
Or might I suggest, rather than the next Indiana Jones film, the next Mummy film?
The next they did reboot the series.
Yes, that's true. You'll be able to sight read the bird hieroglyphic.
Yes, that's right.
Or not even sight read. Just have someone yell at you, it's the bird
one! It's the bird one, yeah, because there's 20 bird hieroglyphs. I think, so we don't really have a Mormon version of, like, monastic self-flagellation. You know, like the monk from the Da Vinci Code does, right? You know, he, like, whips himself. You know, like, that's, I think, the
you're developing your own monastic order.
Exactly. Latter-day Saint self-flagellation.
Exactly. Yeah, so this is basically my version of self-flagellation going into a PhD program. Yeah,
the Order of the Smoots is what it'll be called. And
we tease, but we really wish you luck on your journey. We think you're going to do incredible work pushing forward the field of biblical studies and Egyptology, and I think Latter-day Saints will find a lot of information tangential to supporting their faith.
Thank you. I hope so.
Now, like I said, this is Stephen's last time, and with that introduction, I think it's fair to say we should probably just have him do the entire Come Follow Me session next hour, where he'll just be reverse translating Alma 30 and 31 into back into Egyptian, into Reformed Egyptian specifically.
Well, you know, you joked about that, Neil, but I've been gearing up for my program by sort of re-hitting my grammar books and my Egyptian reading books, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm rereading some hieroglyphic texts and rereading some of my grammar books. And now when I read the Book of Mormon, I'll see these little phrases or these sentences, and I'm really thinking, like, how would I render this in Egyptian if I were going to back-translate this? And I kind of get distracted from, like, the actual message of what I'm reading, because I'm thinking, like, oh, so this prepositional phrase, I wonder if it would be like this in Egyptian, right, or whatever, right? So, yeah, we'll see what we can do with that.
Very, very cool. With that said, why don't we go ahead and get started? It's been a very eventful week or last few weeks. That's maybe just redundant. It's 2020, so every week it seems is eventful. But where do we want to start here?
Well, I might suggest we start with the church newsroom, because the church itself came out with quite a few announcements this week, tangential and related to some of the larger current events going on. One of which is that as COVID-19 restrictions are easing up, here's how the church is going to be moving forward. They released a press release talking about how they're going to start a phased going back to church, and many Latter-day Saints are probably have heard from their local authorities about what their specific plan is. I know Neil and I are going back to church on June 14th, next week, theoretically.
I'm guessing that a lot of people maybe have already even gone back to church already.
It's possible in Utah, and then in other parts of the country a little bit later. They've also started opening up Deseret Industries again, which I am particularly excited about because I just love DI. And then they also summarized their progress on temple work, starting a phased reopening of temples. It's still right now just limited to ceilings, live ordinance ceilings, no proxy work yet. And And also missionary work is continuing to go forward. They're still just assigning missionaries to their home countries and doing virtual MTC experiences where they will be Zooming with their teachers and their companions. They're assigned companions, but they're virtual companions. So you gotta Zoom with your companion and do study every morning and check in with them regularly. It's a new way to do missionary work for sure. Well, that's just one announcement. One of the bigger ones is that General Conference for October 2020 has been officially announced virtual. Just like in April of 2020, we had a virtual-only conference where it was broadcast worldwide as usual, but only a select number of people were in a small auditorium being filmed, and they were practicing social distancing to the best ability, and it appears that we're going to be doing that again. The presidency issued a letter saying, while some areas of the world continue to experience the effects of a serious pandemic, others do not, and as a worldwide organization, we have an obligation to be good citizens and to act with caution. As it relates to such a unique setting as General Conference, which traditionally brings thousands of visitors to Salt Lake City from around the globe, because of our concern for the health and safety of others, we have decided that the October 2020 General Conference will follow the same pattern as the conference held in April of this year. The General Conference sessions will be broadcast as usual, however, the General Sessions will not be open to the public, and more details will come out as we get closer to that event. And so time will only tell what this might mean for General Conference. I know last General Conference was historic in a lot of ways, and it was exciting and inspiring, and we had new announcements left and right. And I don't know, is this one going to be a little boring because we're used to this format now, or will it be just as exciting as before? I personally am looking forward to General Conference again because, once again, I'm feeling plenty of social and community anxiety about the future, and I am very much looking forward to the guidance of a prophet in October.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say that this announcement so much comes as a surprise under the present world we live in. But I will say that I think back in April, no one was imagining that come October, we'd still be in this kind of mode. We were all kind of like, wow, this is crazy and unprecedented that we're doing General Conference this way. But I think kind of looking forward to, in the fall when we would, in our minds, at least things would be getting back to normal. So it's a little disappointing that, we're going to continue in this vein for a bit longer, I think. But like I said, I don't know that it necessarily comes as a big surprise at this point.
One thing that I've learned from various insider sources of mine who work closely with church administration. So, for example, somebody I know who's a regional medical mission advisor for the Western United States is that for better or for worse, the church is, as an organization, most of the time overly cautious about things as a way to just ensure as little risk as possible in posing any sort of danger or threat to either missionaries or just church members in general, right? And so I say this just because some people will take signs of this, or will take some of this, something like this, as a sign of some sort of prophetic insight or something that, some sort of prophetic statement on the future that President Nelson is giving about, like, the length of COVID-19 or something like that. Even though at last General Conference, I think it was President Nelson basically said, we didn't expect this, right? The magnitude of this. So, anyways, I just say this for anybody who's listening to maybe not read too much into this, the fact that they're saying we're not going to have October conference be live. It's probably just them being very, very abundantly cautious. Probably not some sort of prophetic prognostication on where things are going. But I don't know. Things could change, but I think that's probably the safer bet to go with.
Yeah, absolutely. My experience with the church, I would appeal to insider sources by...
That's right. Get on my level, Neil.
The thing is, I am an insider source.
Oh, there you go.
My own experience with the church is just as Stephen said, there's just an abundance of caution. It's that conservatism of the church coming through in certain ways, right? We're just going to err on the side of caution in most instances. So it's yes, go ahead, Hales.
I was just going to say, any time we have conservatism that wants to avoid accidentally killing people, I'd say pass around the conservatism.
Absolutely. So yeah, I don't know that we have anything much more to say on that, unless somebody else wants to speak up. But
yeah, that's about all the information we have for now. But I'm sure the brethren and church officials will be giving us more details as we get closer to General Conference about what this will entail. As far as the other thing that the church issued this week, in light of recent protests and national conversation about race, President Nelson posted on Instagram and Facebook and on his social media accounts, and it was also distributed through the church newsroom, a post about racism and calls for respect for human dignity. And this was a lovely post by our prophet calling all people everywhere to treat people equally and to not harbor racist or prejudiced feelings. He says that we join with many throughout this nation and around the world who are deeply saddened at recent events of racism and a blatant disregard for human life. We abhor the reality that someone would deny others respect and the most basic of freedoms because of the color of his or her skin. We are also saddened at these when these assaults on human dignity lead to escalating violence and unrest. The Creator of us all calls on each of us to abandon attitudes of prejudice against any group of God's children. Any of us who has prejudice towards another race needs to repent. And he goes on, and you can read the post for yourself on the church newsroom or on social media, but he basically just shares the message of the gospel that God loves all of his children, and we need to be behaving in such a way that exemplifies Christ's teachings of love one towards another. And if we do feel like we're harboring prejudice or bias or malice that we maybe weren't even aware of before, then this is a great time for introspection and for repentance and humbling ourselves and turning to the Savior to help us overcome even unintentional harm. Any other thoughts from you guys on President Nelson's statement?
Spencer looked like he wanted to say something.
I'm gonna call you out on air now.
I'll say something because I was thinking about something, but I didn't know like how much.
But just know if what you say is racist, we are gonna shout you down and cancel you.
So, oh yeah, hey, that's okay. I deserve it.
Slightly be perceived as racist. No, just kidding. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I think I would deserve it at that point. You know, so just kick me out of the room or. You know, whatever, unfriend me on Facebook, it's good, you know? Yeah, so I really do appreciate kind of the unity that President Nelson is calling for with the statement. You know, he's kind of condemning both those who would incite violence against people of different races, but he's also, you know, condemning those that would loot and riot and destroy property. And I think that's you know, this is obviously a very touchy subject, but I really do appreciate that we can, like, kind of apply the same standard to everybody when they break the law of love, you know? I think it's interesting. I was pondering about this week, and I just, you know, it seems to me that, you know, the Savior was pretty good at pointing out hypocrisy on all sides, you know, and was pointing out different injustices committed by both sides of people, both the people that were hypocritical and the people that were criticizing others of hypocrisy when they were guilty of hypocrisy. And it just, you know, his teachings on beams and moats really come to my mind strongly in these times, you know, where we have to really be introspective and just kind of take individual responsibility for the things that we do to create these types of problems and, you know, come up with effective solutions for moving forward. So.
Absolutely. Are there any other thoughts? I mean, obviously this is in connection with a lot of the protests that have been going on around the country, and recent events that have incited those protests, the murder of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and some of the other things like that, and all of it, of course, is very sobering, right, and very tragic, and You know, I think there's something to be said for the importance for all of us to, you know, to go through some introspection, right, and consider our own attitudes and thoughts and feelings on race and things like that, and recommit to being better and doing better.
I really appreciated Spencer's point on how President Nelson, it's very unifying what he expressed, because on this topic and many controversial topics, it can be very divisive and fall along political party lines and fall on different ends of the conservative liberal spectrum and cause people to shift apart from each other and entrench themselves on their own sides of what they believe is right or wrong. And in the end, that can cause more harm than good when we're so entrenched on one side or another. And so I appreciate that President Nelson does call for unity and bringing together both sides, that whether you are someone who is fighting against police brutality and are joining in the riots, or someone who has a member on the police force and is really scared for their lives right now, whatever side of this you're on, I think President Nelson and all of us would agree that we are all God's children, and we're all trying to do our best to live according to Christian good principles. And we just need to come together and become part of the body of Christ. And I really do hope that this moment in history will become one where we can humble ourselves before the Lord and come together. I think there's a lot of anger and a lot of hate on all sorts of sides, and a lot of disagreement on a lot of sides for good reasons. It's a complicated situation, but there's a lot of destruction happening as well, politically, physically, and I can only hope that through destruction and through tragedy, that it is an opportunity to humble ourselves before the Lord, so that we can turn to Him, and as a nation, we can perhaps look more towards religion as the source of comfort and guidance for becoming a strong and unified and moral and ethical nation. But only time will tell.
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, I've not been the best observer of all this, but it seems to me that some of the takeaways are that we must have an exceptionally high regard for respecting people's rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and due process of law. And that any time someone is deprived of those, whether it is, well, unjustly that is, whether it is by an officer operating under color of law but not operating within the confines of the law, or whether it is by a group of citizens of whatever sort operating contrary to the law, it doesn't make for people being able to enjoy their lives. And we want to create a nation where people can, all the people, and where every life is fully valued, and where no one can be deprived of the things that they are promised by our Constitution, contrary to its exceptions. And I think that's a world worth working for, because it's a world we can all stand. It's a world we can all make the best of ourselves in, and help each other make the best of each other.
Absolutely.
Like Zion lies somewhere on the other end of all of that, and that's where we want to get to. And so that's the direction we need to be going.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I did actually think is maybe worth mentioning, and maybe Stephen or Spencer can comment on this, is there was an event held in Provo. It wasn't a protest so much as a I don't know what to call it.
A rally.
A rally. Okay, a rally. Mm-hmm. It was led by a number of African American public personalities, I guess. I don't know. Influencers. Yeah, there we go. A number of African-American influencers who live around the Provo area. Stephen and Spencer, I know, attended that event. What would you guys say was kind of the how did it go, and what was the predominant message there?
Yeah, it went actually very well. It was organized by one of our friends, Kwaku L. He is a member, well, formerly was a member of Three Mormons, or Saints Unscripted. And he organized this event with some of his friends, who are people of color, and they decided to put this event together to bring awareness to the issue, and to kind of unite the Provo community kind of under one, I guess, narrative in order to help people. And it was very, very powerful. There were about five or six different speeches given, and these all came from. These were like BYU students and so forth that were just good friends of Quakers, and very, very powerful. Each of them gave a lot of motivation to people, and really kind of provided insight to some of their own kind of their own very personal experiences regarding racism and regarding just some of the struggles and some of the paranoia and that they've kind of felt in their life as far as dealing with these types of issues goes. And very powerful. At the end, there were some musical numbers. There was a musical number by one of my friends who sang Blackbird, which was actually written by Paul McCartney in the height of the civil rights movement. About the civil rights movement, a bird is slang for girl in Britain, and so Blackbird is actually about a black girl, you know, trying to find emancipation from some of that. And so it was very, very powerful. I really enjoyed it. I don't know, but what Stephen thought about it?
No, Spencer, you highlighted pretty much the gist of it there. It was actually really, really moving, some of the moments from some of the speakers. And you could tell that even though there was sort of a mixed audience, there were both black and white attendees. I'm pretty sure that they were predominantly LDS, but I'm sure that there were some non-LDS or maybe even some former LDS people there in the audience. There wasn't ever really a sense of I guess, for lack of a better word, segregation of, like, different, you know, types
right.
of people.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Everybody felt like they were on the same page there. I felt like it was also, like Spencer mentioned, it was very sort of, like, soul-searching, or, like, it made people sort of, like, soul-search, right, with some of the comments that were being made. Because this was very raw, this was very emotional, some of the speakers, and you know, you can only imagine, right? Being African American at a time like this, it probably does hit much more closely than for white people like all of us here in the studio, right? So, I thought it was really good. It was also really great. I liked it because there were a lot of calls to actions from a gospel perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of quotations from Scripture, such as the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants. Lots of examples from LDS history with, like, the Mormon pioneers and things like that, right?
Yeah, they really wanted to relate to kind of the Latter-day Saint experience to the race
right.
experience, so it could be kind of a little bit more comparable, a little bit more, like, understandable.
Sure, yeah,
I think
of course.
They really did a good job
and
with
one
that.
Of the speakers, yeah, one of the speakers, he's a Latino Latter-day Saint living in Provo, sort of a local Provo influencer. He said, you know, the black experience in America and the Latter-day Saint experience in America are not the same things, by any means, right? But there are some comparable overlapping. And so Latter-day Saints who aren't black could, in some ways at least, hopefully understand and sympathize with the black experience in America, since we have our own history of oppression and persecution and exploitation. Again, not nearly to the degree of blacks in America, but enough that we could use that as sort of a point to build common ground and to find empathy and to work together, right? So something that I thought was very meaningful and made a lasting impression on me.
Absolutely, and I will say, as you know, as someone who's read you know, about some of the more horrific events in Latter-day Saint history, you know, it's not hard to. You know, you come away from reading about those sometimes, and yeah, you want to tear it all down. You want to go, you know, you want to join the Danites and
blood atone everyone.
And,
yeah.
Exactly. And so, and relating to that, it isn't. It certainly isn't meant to say that our experience the Latter-day Saint experience is as bad as the African-American experience. But the point is, when I can make that connection and be like, okay, yeah, when I read about this, this is what I want to do, you can understand why people are taking to the streets.
Yes, precisely.
And doing the things they're doing now.
At the very least, we understand what it is to have our rights trampled on by people in positions of public trust.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that on a tremendous scale. And even to have laws passed specifically against us. So there are some points of being able to relate, though obviously it's not going to be exactly the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, unless anybody else has anything to say, I think we're ready to move on. Another event that's kind of been pretty low-key, but it is an event going on in the Latter-day Saint intellectual sphere this last week, was the MHA Virtual Conference, MHA being the Mormon History Association. They had to cancel their in-person conference, which is going to be held... It was going to be held in Palmyra this year for the bicentennial of the Restoration. Unfortunately, with present circumstances being as they are, that was not done. But there was a virtual conference, and we know that our very own Stephen Smoot actually gave a presentation, a video presentation there. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about that, Stephen?
Yeah, sure thing. I didn't catch, Neil, if you mentioned that you and Jasmine were also, we were going to do a panel on that.
Yes.
Oh, you didn't mention that. Okay, sorry. I had a space there for a second.
No, I did not mention that, but originally we were scheduled to do a panel, Stephen, myself, Jasmine, and another one of our coworkers at Book of Mormon Central named Jared Riddick. Unfortunately, with the circumstances being what they were, most of us did not end up having time to record and get our presentation in shape for the virtual conference. But Stephen is more prolific than us all. So
don't you forget it.
So,
I'm just kidding.
So, why are you doing a PhD?
But yeah, Stephen, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, my paper that I gave is titled Corresponds with and Supports the Testimony of the Book of Mormon, Early Latter-day Saint Apologetics and the Reception of the Book of Mormon.
And is that title a quote from something?
It is. The title is a quote from what's called the Bernheisel Letter that was written by Joseph Smith in November of 1841 and was given to John Bernheisel after Joseph Smith got a copy of John Lloyd Stephens and Frederick Catherwood's, and this is one of my favorite titles, Incidents of Travel in Chiapas, Yucatan, and Mexico. Like, it's just such a great 19th century book title.
Right? Oh, it's beautiful. But I want to be clear. So when Joseph Smith in this letter is saying corresponds with and supports the testimony of the Book of Mormon, he is talking about the information in Stephens and Catherwood's book about their explorations in the Yucatan and Chiapas, yes. Mexico.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, and okay, I just wanted that to
no,
be
no,
on
that's
record.
Great.
What's that region called again?
it's called Mesoamerica.
Yeah,
Mesoamerica, okay.
I just have like a random question. Why is it that all these 19th century authors just have these omnibus titles for their books? Like,
I don't know, man, but I kind of missed it. Not going to lie.
I'll tell you this much. Yeah. If you were to transport Oliver Cowdery or W.W. Phelps or even, John Lloyd Stephens to 2020, they would be looking around and being like, why don't you guys have more, like, why can't I tell what any of your books are about from your titles?
Yeah,
like, why are they so short? They would be affronted by how little information is advertised on the front cover. So I think it's just that was kind of the style they wanted you to know exactly what you were getting.
It was kind of, the title page of a book in, like, the 19th century, the pre-modern printing, it was kind of what we would do with, like, a dust jacket.
Yeah.
Or like a back cover of a book, right, that gives like a very rough outline of what it is.
What Nephi might do with a colophon.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Something like that. So so the purpose of my paper, thank you for actually pointing that out, Neil, because the reason I chose this as the title for my paper is I wanted to – I'm basically discussing how early Latter-day Saints – and their critics for that matter, both understood that there were high stakes at play for the historicity or ahistoricity of the Book of Mormon. And so I began with a reminiscence from David Whitmer in my paper. David Whitmer remembered, and he told a reporter in the 1870s, that right as the Book of Mormon was going to press, he and the other witnesses, Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris and these guys, they were really worried because, he says, the Book of Mormon described a civilization with advanced cities and technology and all this stuff and arts and sciences, and there was nothing like this that we knew about at the time, but we got a promise from the Lord that one day there would be discoveries made that would demonstrate the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, right? So the whole point, I frame it in this way to say that the reception of the Book of Mormon by its first readers included a conscious attempt to either demonstrate or disprove the historicity of this book, mm-hmm. and thereby demonstrate or call into doubt the prophetic claims of Joseph Smith. And so I focused on Latter-day Saints such as William Phelps, Harley and Orson Pratt, and Joseph Smith himself and others helping him at the Times and Seasons printing office in 1842 that were attempting to use ancient American antiquities to show the Book of Mormon was historical, that it was an ancient record. There were Latter-day Saint missionaries throughout the 1830s and 40s who were publishing pamphlets and giving lectures that were using whatever was known about ancient America to prove the Book of Mormon was true, basically. But they did it specifically with this idea that if we can prove this book is true, then we can prove that Joseph Smith is a prophet. And so the point of my paper, it's not to argue necessarily that these arguments are good or bad, just to show that they were made, just to document history behind how the first readers of the book engaged this book. And I basically made the argument that, there's a growing trend in academia to discuss what's called reception history of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning discussing how readers basically received and interpreted and understood the text and engaged with the text, right?
Right.
And I think that's a very worthwhile area of exploration. But one thing I've noticed is that there's a lot of, especially non-LDS academics who discuss the reception of the Book of Mormon, they're super touchy about the historicity of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why that is, but I basically wanted to force the issue and say, look, if you want to do 19th century American reception of the Book of Mormon, that's fine. We should be doing that. But you have to also discuss historicity, because they were discussing historicity in the 19th century. The earliest mm-hmm. Latter-day Saints and non-Latter-day Saints were arguing this just like we're arguing about it today. And so you can't pretend like this wasn't a factor with why and how people were reading and engaging with this book.
Right, yeah.
And so that was sort of the point of my paper, and I gave a lot of examples, but I love the Bernheisel letter quote because it basically, and it's coming from Joseph Smith himself, it basically captures how early Latter-day Saints were using discoveries of American antiquities at the time.
Right. And so I think, did you have something to say, Hales?
Oh, just briefly that the way that they were looking at it was entirely rational.
Uh-huh.
If the Book of Mormon can be shown to be an ancient text, or a text that is rooted in an ancient text, so since we do claim it's a translation, right, then the only way it could reasonably be that is if it was given by revelation. Because Joseph Smith, in and of himself, had no capability to write anything about ancient America or South America or any America. And so the only way that he had access to that time period in its history would be by supernatural means. So it means that if you ever show that the Book of Mormon is a work rooted in history, then you've shown a lot more than just that, because you've shown, in fact, that God has acted very sharply in that history, and that's a very remarkable situation. Like, plenty of people accept that the Bible had its roots in some kind of historical events, but may not necessarily accept its spiritual meaning. But if you accept that the Book of Mormon originated in historical events, then the implications for its spiritual meaning are immediate.
Right.
So it's good that you mentioned that, Hales, because I want to read the comments of John E. Page, who I cite in my paper. He was a Latter-day Saint missionary in the eastern states in the 1840s, and he published this in a newspaper on July 1st, 1842. He says he was trying to basically explain why we have these ruins. So Stevens and Catherwood, they published their book in 1840. In 1841, it is the first time some Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo starts publishing and citing it in the Times and Seasons. In 1842, by this point, it's gone bananas, right? People just love this stuff. And Johnny Page is trying to explain, basically, how do we have these monumental ruins, right, that Stevens and Catherwood have described? And he does it by saying the following. So I'll just read from my paper here. A fellow missionary, Johnny Page, also serving in the eastern United States, published an article on July 1st, 1842, that attempted to explain the monumental ruins of Central America as the result of the great destruction described in the Book of Mormon's account of Christ's visit to the Nephites. The discoveries of, quote, those efficient antiquarians, Messrs. Catherwood and Stevens, end quote, could, according to Page, solve the mystery of how the great civilizations of Central America vanished. And here's Page again. Quote, read the Book of Mormon. Let the reader observe that the Book of Mormon was published in A.D. 1830. The discovery of this city by Messrs. Catherwood and Stevens was in 1840. If the Book of Mormon is a fiction, no difference who wrote it, how did it happen to locate this city so nicely before it was known to exist till 1836 by any account that was extant in America from which it could have been extracted, end quote. So Page literally makes this argument, and I go on to quote him in a letter to 1844. He writes to Joseph Smith right before Joseph Smith dies. He's on his mission still. He writes to Joseph Smith. He has this big, long letter talking about his missionary activities and even says, go ahead and publish this in the Times and Seasons if you want to because of how cool this is.
Uh-huh.
And Page basically says, here's his hook for his missionary work. He goes around with a copy of Stevens and Catherwood, and he gives these public lectures, and he forces the issue back on his non-Mormon listeners. And he says, how do you explain that Joseph Smith got all this right about ancient America because he published his book in 1830, but Stevens and Catherwood didn't publish their book till 1840? So what do you have to say about that, huh? And Page says that the response is people are, in his words, astonished and astounded at this, right? So Hales, you're exactly right that it's completely understandable why they'd make this argument, because logically it works, at least within this framework, right? And I feel like we need to acknowledge that, and so that's what I wanted to discuss in part in my paper.
And I'll tell you what I find very striking about all of this is while the data is obviously different, and much of the data that Page would have been using and others in the 19th century wouldn't be considered the best or most reliable to draw upon for us today. So the data is different, but the argument is quite often the same. In fact, we could talk about this week's interpreter paper in connection with this in a certain respect. From Brian Stubbs, he, for those of you who are not familiar with Brian Stubbs and his research, it's a good thing to check out. I think you'll be very interested. But this was published in Interpreter just this weekend. It's an answer to those who have criticized his work. He's a linguist, and his area of specialty is the Uto-Aztecan language family. That is a language group that was spoken by Native Americans predominantly in the western United States and down into Mexico and the northern part of Mesoamerica. And he also is one of very few linguists who has training not only in New World languages like the Uto-Aztecan family, but also has training in Semitics and ancient Near Eastern languages. And so he sees connections between Semitic languages and the Uto-Aztecan language family that nobody else has seen. And in fact, it was connections between Semitic and Northwest Semitic, to be specific, Hebrew and Aramaic, some of the languages Stephen was talking about earlier that he'll get to study in his program there, and Egyptian. He sees connections between those languages and Uto-Aztecan. And some of those actually helped him explain some things in Uto-Aztecan and produce a more comprehensive grammar and dictionary of the Utah Aztec language. It was a very well-received grammar and dictionary from his colleagues in Utah Aztec studies. But then he came out with a book a couple years later saying, hey guys, here's how I did it. I drew on Egyptian and Semitic, and I think that they had direct contact with Egyptian and Semitic speakers from around the early part of the first millennium BC. He doesn't pin it down specifically to 600 BC, but that would be pretty much impossible linguistically. But the early part of the first century BC, basically roughly about 1000 BC to 500 BC, let's say. And
they identify the period of Egyptian it's from, right?
Well, yes, it's New Kingdom Egyptian, and it's I don't know what you'd call that period for Hebrew and Aramaic, but it's early. I mean, it's early biblical.
I've heard you can say sort of like early Hebrew. I've also heard like classical Hebrew, because this is when the biblical texts start to be composed in the Hebrew that we now recognize. But yeah, it'd be late Egyptian would be the Egyptian, the form of Egyptian we're talking about here.
Right.
Maybe classical Hebrew.
And of course he's gotten some support from linguists. Dirk Elzinga, who's another Utoaztecanist, wrote a very positive review of his work. John Robertson, who is a linguist in Mayan studies, wrote a very positive review. He may have graduated from Harvard. I don't know. I know that he was at BYU, and so was Dirk Elzinga. But Robertson is a very, very well respected. He's right up there with Steve Houston and the like as one of the very best Mayan linguists. Roger Westcott. So there have been some positive reviews, but there have been some negative reviews from Chris Rogers in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, and from what's his name, Magnus Hansen, who's also a Utoaztecanist, who wrote some critical, had some negative feedback. So this is Brian Stubbs responding to all this.
As I respond, Magnus is an expert in Nahuatl?
Nahuatl, yeah. So there's been some pushback, and Brian is responding to this, but the point here is, if Brian Stubbs is right, that there's a significant infusion of and contact between speakers of Utoaztecan and speakers of Hebrew and Egyptian in the early part of the first millennium B.C., you can kind of do the same thing John Page is doing in the 1840s, right? How are you going to explain this? This is... Now, to be clear, Stubbs never says this proves the Book of Mormon is true. And we aren't going to say that it proves the Book of Mormon true either. But the point is, the Book of Mormon predicts exactly this. And so if this is correct, how are you going to explain it? How did Joseph Smith nail this?
What I've been very surprised by, too, is that it's not that he's just found a connection. It's that he's found a pretty enormous data set to try and make this to make this connection. And I've also been kind of surprised to link this also to recent LIDAR-like technology that's uncovered so many other there's so many other sites that we haven't even gotten to yet. There's so much about that it's increased our estimates of ancient Mesoamerican population into the millions, right? And I'm kind of like, wow, like this must have been just a massive civilization and a massive melting pot of a lot of different cultures, and we're just starting to figure out all of this, and so it's very exciting, and it's very like, I mean, I think of that guy from the History Channel, like, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
We believe in aliens here.
We do believe in aliens.
Go ahead, Hiss.
Oh. I was just groaning at the aliens comment. That's all.
I do think I'm not a linguist by any stretch of the imagination, but I have followed Brian Stubbs's work and the progress on it for most of the last 10 years, I think there's something substantive here. It's been hard to get what I would consider a fair-minded critique from someone who really knows what they're talking about, because there's just there's almost an instant prejudice against the idea of old world and new world linguistic contact. But he has marshaled a massive amount of evidence here, and he's an important voice that needs to be taken very, very seriously. But the point, my point in bringing it up was, I think it connects exactly to what Stephen's talking about. Today, even today, we have people who are, you know, like I said, the data's different, but the argument's the same. If the Book of Mormon's not true, then how did this connection happen? Why are we seeing Egyptian and Hebrew show up in a New World language family? You know, it's just one of those things, you know, and people may have their answer to that, or they may just dismiss what Brian Stubbs has done. But my point is, they were making that argument in the 19th century, and it's an argument we can still make today. It's not just one that we do. I think we have some good grounds to make it on.
Well, what came out in my research as I wrote this paper, exactly as you're saying, Neil, is our methods have gotten more sophisticated, but the methodology has basically stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because this is basically the methodology you have to grapple with when you have a text like the Book of Mormon. So, yes, our data has improved, and our arguments have improved, and the methods of how we make the arguments have improved and have become more sophisticated. But we're basically making the same argument as has been made in the 1830s and 40s about this book. The other example I love that I cite in my paper is anachronisms in the Book of Mormon. There was a sectarian critic of Mormonism in the 1830s. His name is Leroy Sunderland, which is a great name. And he wrote a pamphlet attacking Mormonism, and Parley P. Pratt responded to him. And Leroy Sunderland made a bunch of arguments about anachronisms in the Book of Mormon, including our favorite one, the compass. The Liahona, right? The Book of Mormon says there's a compass. Well, the answer Parley P. Pratt gave is almost identical to answers that are being given today for anachronisms. The first thing he says is, first of all, if God is involved in this, you can't rule that out entirely. But second of all, Pratt says, he just says something like, I have it on the authority of very learned men, right, that the compass is as old as the Chaldeans and the Egyptians, right? And he makes the argument that, no, it's not an anachronism. Like,
right.
It's attested in antiquity. So, again, that's almost identical to the arguments that are being made today for and against anachronisms in the book, right?
Right?
So
right.
It's very striking, and I think... again, I sort of wanted to push the issue here with my paper, but the Brian Stubbs work, it's very nicely dovetails into it, as you described.
And one thing I actually want to note in relation to what you're talking about here, there, I think it is important to understand that this is something that is a part of the intellectual history of the Book of Mormon, its reception history, as Stephen talked about, from the very beginning. I mean, even the very act of calling witnesses to attest to the reality of the plates and to publish their testimony alongside of it is kind of a statement from day one that this is real, right? And you should believe this because there is historical antiquity connected to it. There's an artifact connected to it, right? And there are others who saw and handled it. You know, really kind of from day one. And I think sometimes... In discussions about this online with people who favor a inspired fiction view and things like that, sometimes we push them to try and explain the witnesses and their testimony. I would like to see someone explain why the witnesses at all. Forget about trying to explain away what they have to say. Why even have the witnesses if the historicity of the text is not important? And not just important to that immediate first-generation audience, but if you believe this is inspired fiction, that God is involved in it somehow, why have the witness? Why is it important to God? Why does he call witnesses and ask them to testify to the reality of this artifact that's supposed to be connected to this text if grounding it in antiquity is not important? But there's also... I won't name any names, but there is some people who have argued that... who favor a more inspired fiction type of approach, who've argued that modern apologists, as in, you know, late 20th, early 21st century apologists, people like us, are the ones who have conflated historicity and historical concern with the divine authenticity of the Book of Mormon text. And I think what Stephen's doing here is important in showing that, no, that if it is a conflation, That conflation starts from the very beginning, first generation, 1830s, 1840s, and it starts with Joseph Smith.
So to that point, let me quote William W. Phelps. He's called by revelation to be a printer and editor for the church in Zion, Jackson County, Independence. And he starts the Evening of the Morning Star in 1831. This is literally in the first issue of the Evening in the Morning Star, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the first issue, Phelps says, the reason I'm starting this newspaper is to get everybody ready for the second coming, right? That's basically right out of the bat. That's why he's starting this newspaper, right? The millennium is happening any day now, and I'm going to get everybody ready by declaring the gospel. Okay?
We could maybe use someone starting a newspaper like that in 2020, I think.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And
anyway, continue.
In the inaugural issue, Phelps publishes on the Book of Mormon, okay? As part of this, and he later goes on to republish extracts of the book in Jackson County, right? Here's what he says. As part of this effort to, like, get everybody to believe the Book of Mormon because the Second Coming is happening, you got to get ready. Quote, independent of Bible proof on the subject before us, and he's talking about the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, we have the remains of towns, cities, forts, etc., which silently declare to the beholder, we were built by a civilized people, end quote. Literally, in the first church newspaper, they're saying, the history of the Book of Mormon proves it's true. These artifacts, this antiquity we found, these antiquities prove it's true. Therefore, you need to get ready for the millennium and repent, for God's kingdom is coming really soon.
And this is, if I'm not mistaken, this is 1832 or 31. Okay.
This is 1831.
So this is the Book of Mormon still, like, fresh off the press. Like, it's, this is almost immediately.
I'm sorry, you're right, 32. June 1832.
June 1832.
He's called in 1831 to be the printer, and June 1832 is when the first issue comes out. But
okay.
Yes, we're within 2 years of when the church has been organized.
Is very early, yeah. Anyway, I think we've probably covered that topic pretty sufficiently, and it is now 8 o'clock. Does anyone else have anything they want to discuss before we move into our Come Follow Me portion of the show? No? Okay. Well, then why don't we go ahead and make that transition? We're probably going to get interrupted by our intro music in a few minutes, but let's go ahead and move on. We are covering for Come Follow Me this week, Alma 30 and 31.
So with Alma 30 and 31, we are coming right into Alma's continued missionary journeys as he's going from city and city to preach the gospel. In chapter 30, Korihor the Antichrist comes into the land, and then after he preaches his doctrines, he's kicked out of Jershon. They bring him before the high priest, who's Alma, and there is a trial where they try Korihor for his teachings, and ultimately he is struck dumb. Alma 31 is the Zoramites are threatening defection, and so Alma the Younger, with his A-team squad of missionary sons, essentially, go out to preach to them, and they behold what they're doing and the apostasy happening in the land of Antionum, where the Zoramites are, and they attempt to preach the gospel to them. So that's the storyline that we're covering today. And, you know, we're only getting a little bit of a slice of the larger arc, since we're missing the missionary journeys that happened right before this, which we would have already studied in Come Follow Me, and we're not quite getting to Alma's speeches to the Zoramites in Alma 32 and 33, etc. And so we're just kind of getting the intro right here. But there's a lot of great stuff going on with between these two stories of Korihor and the Zoramites, both examples of hubris and pride and apostasy and the effects of that. And so let's just dive right into chapter 30. I know a lot of us have great things we can talk about this from a legal standpoint, from a political standpoint, a philosophical standpoint. Korihor is it's called an antichrist, and this offers a great opportunity to ask questions of what constitutes apostasy, what was it exactly about Korihor's arguments that were so bad, and what caused ultimately for him to lose, and what can we learn from that today? Does anyone have things they want to just start spouting out off the bat, out of the gate, with Alma 30? Sometimes we can take it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the notion of an antichrist and what the notion of an antichrist is, because it actually comes from New Testament times, apparently, and the Greek preposition anti is meant to be used to talk about, like, meant to refer to, like, something.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And anyway,
that you got theme songed.
I did.
But before we continue, since it is the top of the hour here, I'm just going to go ahead and reintroduce everyone in case you're just joining us. This is the Interpreter Show, as it just said, and I'm Neil Rapley, joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley, Spencer Marsh, who was just giving us the eloquent discourse on anti in Greek, and Stephen Smoot is here as well, and then it is Hales Swift joining us by phone. We are now covering the Come Follow Me portion of our discussion, and we are talking about Alma 30 and 31, and Spencer is just talking to us about what it means to be an antichrist. Go ahead, Spencer.
And during the theme music, I was actually explaining to them to the people here in the studio how I was going to steal a Declaration of Independence, and I've recruited them to my team, so we're good. We're on a success. We've had success. Yes.
That's not true. Please, NSA, don't
So, yeah, anti in Greek is to refer to instead, or kind of the, you know, we have the word in English antithesis, which is like the opposite thesis, right? The opposite point of view. And so when you say antichrist, you are against Christ. You are something that mirrors Christ. And also the Greeks would use this to talk about, for instance, like a mirror, you know, where you look into a mirror and you see yourself and you're kind of against yourself, but it's not really you. It's kind of a fake you. And so when we say an antichrist, we're talking about something that's a mirage. It's a mirror image. It's not really there. It's not really true. It's kind of a resemblance of it. And according to the commentary that I was just reading, early Christian apologists would use this to refer to, like, Gnostics. For instance, that would say that God is just kind of this, this ethereal essence, and so there were some, like, internal religious debates about doctrine, about God and who God was, and so early Christian apologists would use this to kind of say that, yeah, you're just an antichrist, you don't have the real Christ, you don't have the real thing, and so that's kind of what we're starting out with here, is with the notion of an antichrist is someone who is kind of a fake, who's kind of like has like a resemblance or a semblance of niceness and of being with Christ, but are not really with Christ. You know, they're kind of a mirage. Anyway, I think that's very appropriate imagery for a lot of the stuff that even we see today, and that what the Come Follow Me manual wants us to kind of talk about and focus on.
Yeah, that's a good point. And when we are first introduced to the Antichrist, it's in verse 6. It says that. Well, before I read verse 6, I think it's important to also have verse 5. There's a nice contrast between the peace that's happening in the land right before Korihor enters the scene. There's, at the beginning of chapter 30, they're coming off a gruesome battle, and they are burying their dead, and they're filled with mourning and fasting, and probably going through the motions that the law of Moses would have required for observing veneration for the dead. But after that was over, after the period of mourning and fasting and sackcloth and ashes was over, it says in verse 5 that there was continual peace. And to be continued, da-da-dum, in verse 6, what do you know? Now the peace is disrupted. And who disrupts it? It's the Antichrist. It's Korihor. And this is endemic for the rest of the book of Alma. I mean, there's just apostasy after apostasy and dissension and fractures in the Nephite unity that cause wars and battles in the later chapters in Alma.
It's maybe worth pointing out real quick that their way of healing fractures, apparently both individually and as a group, involved fasting and mourning and prayer. And that seems like it's a good and appropriate approach for our own times and circumstances in which there's plenty in need of repairing. So,
and it kind of reminds me, at least, of this April when we did a worldwide fast twice, for fasting that the pandemic would slow its spread and the people who were suffering and in need at the time would have the healing and the things that they needed. I think I just wanted to comment really quickly on this idea of the fractures within Nephite society that we see, because I think it's something, as people blaze through their Book of Mormon reading once every 4 years, and they read these different stories, and they're primarily looking for teachings about Christ and the gospel, which is understandable and appropriate. I think what we often miss, especially in this whole first half of Alma, from Alma 1 to Alma 30, to Alma 35, really, is there is something going on in Nephite society through this whole phase. You have so many break-off groups and so many civil wars, really. Not even, or at least when they do go to war with the Lamanites, it's instigated by people who have dissented from the Nephite people, from the Nephite group and things like that. And I just wanted to note that these are hints of something a lot more socially complex just underneath the text that we're missing. And Spencer talked earlier about LIDAR studies that are showing how socially how massive the populations were in Mesoamerica and the natural in connection with that. I won't even try to say
corollary.
That's the one. but in connection with that, it's natural that the populations were a lot more culturally and ethnically diverse than we tend to think. Especially, we have a propensity to assume monolithic culture throughout the Americas, really, and see it as pretty homogenous. And it's a lot more complex, and the Book of Mormon is kind of hinting at a lot of this complexity itself. The Nephite society was a lot more complex than just, hey, we're the good guys who believe in Christ, right? There is much, much more going on here. And it's more complex than just, hey, we're the descendants of Nephi and Jacob and Joseph and Zoram. There's evidently a lot more diversity going on that we're missing from just a surface read.
So now that we've been introduced to Korihor, let's get to know some of his teachings as we go to verse 7. Hales, would you like to enlighten us, please?
Well, the first thing in verse 7 that I had a comment on was, it says, now there was no law against a man's belief, for it was strictly contrary to the commands of God that there should be a law which should bring men onto unequal grounds. And I love that, because it is wonderfully comforting that God himself is opposed to thought, to laws regarding thought crime. We are allowed to believe or disbelieve according to what naturally arises in us when we're exposed to facts and arguments and all. And if for some reason we just don't get it, or we disagree, or whatever, he doesn't think we should be persecuted for that. So
God isn't an authoritarian conservative, Hales? That kind of shakes my faith a little.
Right.
Bit.
Oh, boy. Yeah. God seems to be squarely on the side of the libertarians in this verse. So there.
It is interesting, though, because it talks about how they didn't litigate a man's belief. However, it goes on in the next verses that, if he murdered a man, he was punished. If he broke the law, they litigate against incorrect action, but not incorrect belief. And John W. Welch, in his treatment of this chapter, talks about how this brings in a new wrinkle to the equation. And, what do you do? Because Korihor is using speech. Now, does that fall under the auspices of belief, or does that fall under the auspice of action? And it is a little bit of a gray area. And now in America, we're used to our First Amendment rights about free speech, and that, and in our view, we kind of categorize that under belief and thought. About, however, in ancient Israelite law, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. And so it just brings a little bit of a complicating factor. And so it's interesting to watch how Alma deals with this maybe gray area of thought versus action.
And I think it is worth noting, this kind of freedom is pretty radical for the ancient world, right? This is... It's not totally unprecedented necessarily, especially as you get to the age of empires like the Greek Empire, the Alexandrian Empire, and the Roman Empire. They would usually let their conquered peoples continue to worship as they please. So there was some sense of freedom of belief to some extent, but nonetheless, it's not a really widespread thing. Usually, a kingdom or a city state or a people are defined by both their politics and their religion fused together as one. And there's still a lot of that going on in the Book of Mormon.
Right. Separation of church and state is very much a modern concept. And so it is innovative that the institution of judges became a thing in Alma.
And you see, this is another one of those things in this whole first part of Alma that is one of the struggles that they're trying to deal with is now that we're allowing a more free exercise of belief, where do we draw those lines? What exactly does that mean? Can people preach what they believe? Can they actually practice different religious orders and things like that? Or is this just you're allowed to believe what you want, but shut up and don't say anything? And then, Nahor at the beginning of Alma is a challenge to this, and he makes it a little easier because he kills somebody, and so you did act illegally. But Korihor, we don't have any record of him actually committing a crime, and so now we have to really confront this question: what does it mean to let a man believe as he wishes? So anyway, that's part of this complexity that is just underneath the surface of the text here.
And that might reasonably lead to the question of what exactly is it that Korihor believes.
I know that Stephen Smoot has some interesting thoughts on this topic.
Well, I guess we could just jump into it. So a lot of people are accustomed to describing Korihor as an atheist. Both members of the church who read this, but also people who have said that Korihor is an anachronistic figure in the Book of Mormon because he's, as they read the text, he's saying that there is no God, there's no afterlife, there's no divine order of things. There's just nature, basically, and that because of that, there's no real objective moral standard by which to judge human actions, right? Whatever man does is no crime. Every man prospers according to his genius. That's going to be an important point to come back to, etc. So this is the common way that people have read what Korihor is teaching in a nutshell, right? And if we look at the text... Where does it start? I think it's when he gets down to, that's kind of a rough summary of the text. I can't find exactly when the chapter it actually describes it, but that's basically what
well, in
here.
What are you looking for? What are you looking for?
Where it basically starts to describe what Korihor was teaching. The other thing, of course, he teaches that there's no Christ that's going to come, because obviously that's stupid.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, go ahead.
He teaches that no one can know of things to come. He seems to be using that as a basis for discrediting the idea of the coming of Christ, and it seems to be extending from that to the existence of their God in general.
Right, so that's in verse 24, 25, and then 27... is when he starts throwing shade on basically Alma and the priestly hierarchy, right? This is where he says, you people are just glutting off of the labors of these poor people that are being taken advantage of and so forth. So there's both a sort of a theoretical and philosophical objection that Korihor has, and also sort of like a moral objection, right? So he accuses Alma and the priestly hierarchy of basically cynically exploiting people because of the stupid religion that they're telling people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a nutshell about Core Horse teaching. But the thing I want to bring out here, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just want to point out the fact that the things that Core Horse denounces specifically, that there's no God and there's no afterlife, this is what gets people to say, and that there's no real divine order to things, it's just whatever nature is. This is what people say, people used to say Core Horse is an atheist. However, and I'll recommend people go to Book of Mormon Central and look up the Know Why number 532, titled, Was Core Horse Really an Atheist? And the basic point of this article, which yours truly was the principal author and researcher behind, is
nice.
All of the objections that Core Horse makes against Alma and the Nephite religion, you can find other people in the ancient world making the same objections or, like, raising the same arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not like that. So the way people think about it is, once upon a time, human beings just blindly believed in gods and in supernatural powers until smart white Europeans came around with the Enlightenment and decided to stop believing all the superstitious nonsense, and they finally decided we don't have to believe in God and the afterlife anymore, and that's where modern atheism comes from, right? That's a very simplified version, but that's not actually true. And in the Know, I quote the classicist Tim Whitmarsh, and here's a quote. Quote, atheism is demonstrably at least as old as the monotheistic religions of Abraham, which means at least as old as the monotheism of Israel, end quote. And then you can go through and see the different sources that I cite here in the Know Why. But here's my point I'm going to raise, and then I'll turn the time over. Core Horse was not an atheist by the modern definition of the word. And here's why. Core Horse acknowledges that divine supernatural beings exist, because he acknowledges that an angel came to him and told him to say this stuff, and that, oh, I guess that angel was Satan. Right? Like,
right.
You're not an atheist if you think that Satan and angels exist. Full stop. Okay? The other thing that Core Horse says, and this is where I think if you...
At least not a very good one.
Yeah, right? Not a good atheist. But Core Horse says specifically, every man prospers according to his genius. Where does that word genius come from? It comes from... this sense of a supernatural entity that downloads this thing for you, right? And so...
It's if I'm not mistaken, it's related to genie.
That's right.
Yeah.
You rub a lamp and you have a genie, which is a supernatural
entity. Yeah. So in Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary, it says this, quote, among the ancients, this is the definition for genius in Joseph Smith's day, the primary definition. Among the ancients, a good or evil spirit or demon supposed to preside over a man's destiny in life, that is, to direct his birth and actions and to be his guard and guide. A titulary deity, the ruling and good protecting power of men, places, or things. Okay? So when Core Horse says every man prospers according to his genius, I'm convinced he means there are supernatural entities out there that are controlling the universe. And we're helpless to basically, we're helpless to do anything about it. So what Core Horse is doing, he is denying the operative power of the God of Israel, the God of the Nephite religion. He is denying that Yahweh or Jehovah has any operative power in the cosmos, because everybody is just basically at the mercy of these geniuses out there controlling things.
Right.
That's not an atheistic argument, okay? So anyways, I won't go into more into it, but check out the Know Why that elaborates on this. But basically, what Core Horse teaching, fundamentally, Alma, your Nephite God, even if he does exist, is impotent to do anything to change the world. And that includes bringing the Messiah, and that includes this Christ person coming to save the world from sin.
Right.
So that's fundamentally Core Horse's argument.
Which also makes sense of why he's asking for a sign, because his worldview fundamentally includes a great variety of individual auxiliary entities, any of which may decide to help or harm you, but he's just saying this particular one does not have dominion over all of this. It's your familiar spirit, I guess you'd say, that you need to be getting the juice from.
Right.
Okay.
And so, as he goes on and puts forth his teachings, he's brought before Alma, and this is what John W. Welch considers the formal trial of Core Horse, since Alma is the high priest, and he's acting in somewhat of a... a legal position right now in conjunction with the chief judge. He and the chief judge seem to be working together in this way to prosecute Korihor, but he does it in an interesting way as he's Korihor brings his complaints before Alma that you know, there is no God, there is no Christ to come, and you glut yourselves upon the people. Then Alma responds with his defense that that's false. We labor with our own hands, and we don't extract anything for our labor in a religious capacity. That's why we separated church and state. And as far as a God, all of these things testify that there is a God. And so then he turns the question around on Korihor. What evidence do you have that there is no God? And in that way, he really does turn the tables. And behold, I say unto you that you don't have any evidence except your word only. And John W. Welch points out that this is interesting because while Alma, I mean, when we think of a legal trial, we're thinking in very modern terms, but in the ancient world, their concept of evidence was also pretty different. And so for Alma, his evidence entails many witnesses. He's a witness that God exists. His father is a witness that God exists. Nature is a witness that God exists. And Korihor is only one man. And one witness is not enough under the law of Moses to prove something. You need at least two witnesses. And so he makes that point. Believest thou, or I say unto you that ye have none, save it be your word only. You are alone. And then he continues to excoriate Korihor and how you have a lying spirit and you've been deceiving his people. And then that's when Korihor says, if thou wilt show me a sign that I may be convinced that there is a God, yea, show unto me that he hath power, and then I will be convinced of the truth of thy words. And Welch explains how this is basically Korihor's last straw. I mean, he's kind of backed into a corner legally from an ancient law perspective, and now he's asking for an ordeal. And in the ancient world, an ordeal is something where you're basically demanding divine intervention to prove. It's almost like the Salem witch trials, where you dunk the witch in the water, and if she floats, she's a witch. If she drowns, she died, but at least she was innocent. You know, you're asking for some supernatural way to determine who's true and who's false if you're at an impasse. And so that's kind of what Korihor is doing. He's asking for an ordeal or a divine manifestation to determine the legal result of this trial. And then that's exactly what happens. Alma says, okay, I'll give you one last chance. Will you deny that there's a God? Da, da, da. Korihor insists, no, I'm sticking with my case. And so then he gets struck dumb. And this is also kind of an interesting poetic punishment, if you will, because it's Korihor's speech that is causing such chaos. And that's what his crime is. It's through the speech. It's kind of a talionic justice, eye for an eye thing, because he is speaking evil. His speech is taken away. And then, of course, when Korihor asks if he can have that, now that he believes, like, oh, yeah, okay, now that I'm struck dumb, I believe that God is real. Can you take the curse off me? And, of course, Alma says, because he will continue to deceive the people. Any other thoughts you guys have?
Kind of like that comedian who ends his jokes with, here's your sign.
Just to say, you point out, Jasmine, that the evidentiary standards are very different in the ancient world from the modern world. I think we sometimes don't appreciate that, since we live in a super secular, especially in the West, we live in this very secular world, right, where courts are, like, by their nature, secular courts cannot adjudicate religious claims. But this is fundamentally not the case in the ancient world or even in some parts of the modern world. And so you really have to take yourself out of the modern mindset to understand the trial of Korihor from this legal perspective. And once you do, I think it makes a lot of sense of what's going on here and why Alma would approach it the way he does, as you just described.
I think one thing that's interesting is that he claims that no man can know of things to come. But a logical corollary to that is that no man can know things, that any particular event is not to come. And Alma uses this against him when he says, and now what evidence have ye that there is no God or that Christ cometh not? By saying Christ cometh not, he is making an assertion about the future, of which he has said that no man can know anything, so he must be just talking out his backside by his own logic. So, kind of a fun exploitation of the self-contradictory nature of his argument.
And after the trial is over, and after it's proven that Korihor has been struck dumb because God is not with him, God is with Alma, they have this interesting statement at the end that there was a proclamation sent forth by the chief judge to all the people in the land, declaring unto those who had believed in the words of Korihor that they must speedily repent, lest the same judgments would come unto them. And this is pretty interesting. This isn't something you would see in a modern legal case necessarily, but in the ancient world, Korihor's teachings were found guilty, and thus anyone else who believed them and would teach likewise, they're also could be prosecuted under the law now that they've set that legal precedent. And so I think that's really interesting. And it's an interesting foreshadow at the very end of this episode. When Korihor is cast out, he goes from city to city begging for food, and it's a pathetic in the pitying form. You know, it's a sympathetic sort of thing that he's begging for his life at the end. And in the end, he goes to the land of the Zoramites, and he was run upon and trodden down even until he was dead. And thus we see the end of him who perverteth the ways of the Lord. It's pretty dramatic and pretty literarily eloquent, but it's a little bit of a foreshadowing of the next episode. Who were the people that trod down Korihor? The Zoramites. Who on earth could be so horrible to trample down a person? Well, we are going to find out in the next chapter. And if there's
people at the Who concert.
If there's no other thoughts people have, we could segue into that chapter now.
You left out my favorite part. And thus we see that the devil will not support his children at the last day. We get two little moral takeaways there from this, and it's the second one that I really especially enjoy personally.
I had like one comment going back actually kind of towards the beginning of the chapter, towards I forget the first. It says that, you know, he says that all these beliefs that the Nephites hold are the effects of a frenzied mind. That's kind of, I love how he talks about mm-hmm. that. And that's kind of the same way that a lot of secularists will talk today about religious experience in general, that it's just the result of a frenzied mind. But I think that I won't comment too long on this. All I wanted to say, though, is that I think that, you know, some of these arguments that secularists will make are kind of cheap and kind of one-sided, because they kind of assume different things about God that just aren't true. And I think that these religious experiences, I mean, they're real to so many of us, and they actually can provide us with evidence of true things. You know, I think Neil and I were talking about this one time, and, you know, Neil made the good point that, I mean, if a person, you know, is to be sitting in their house, and they're preparing, I think Neil told the story that it was a sister in his ward that was like preparing flowers or something, or she had just come home from church, and she received some sort of prompting in order to go to this person's house and knock on the door. And they were
this is actually a story Jasmine told.
Oh, really?
Told in her Relief Society.
Jasmine, do you know what I'm referring to right now? Okay, she's kind of shaking her head now. But the gist that Neil told me was that she received this prompting to go over to this one sister's home in order to talk to her. And
she was her visiting teacher.
Was her visiting teacher? Okay. And that they went over, and apparently, like, she was about to commit suicide or something like that, and needed kind of someone to talk to.
Now
Jasmine remembers. Now Jasmine remembers. She made a big face, a big oh, you know, just as she remembers. And you know, when we have these types of experiences, I mean, a lot of us can talk about these types of very sacred, special experiences that we have, but I mean, these types of experiences just don't—they don't come from a frenzied mind. And when we have noticeable impressions saying, "Hey, you need to go do this right now," like, it is something that we hold very sacred. And I mean, it's—I think that a lot of people will take these religious experiences for granted when they really can provide us with some special knowledge that we wouldn't otherwise have.
Well, I'll tell you this much: if experiences like the one you were just referring to come from a frenzied mind, we need a lot more frenzied minds.
We need
out
a lot
because,
of frenzied minds.
Because,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, this was an experience that literally saved a life, okay?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I don't think they come from a frenzied mind. I think they come from the world of spirits, right? Our Heavenly Father. And they are important, and they may not be the kind of thing that's going to win you an argument with an atheist on Facebook, but they absolutely count as evidence and personal evidence that that can carry a testimony and can help you through very difficult times sometimes.
One day I am going to write a book, though, about how that can win you an argument against atheists on Facebook. I actually have a book planned for that. So
excellent.
It's a good point, though, that people a lot of times mischaracterize the spirit as only being about feelings and completely neglect to mention the informative nature of many of the spiritual experiences that we have that give us information that we could not have reasonably gotten by our available circumstances and allow us to do good and, in some cases, prevent tragedies that were absolutely imminent and in need of help. So that it never underestimate the informative power of the Holy Ghost. And that would be my thought on it.
That's beautiful. And that's a great way to wrap up Alma 30. And with that, we'll move on to Alma 31. And we'll just start diving in. If anyone has comments, just please just dive on in and interrupt me. So we're talking about how after the end of Korihor, Alma received tidings that the Zoramites were perverting the ways of the Lord. Shocker there. Someone killed Korihor, and it seems that they were perverting the ways of the Lord. And so because Alma was buried down in great sorrow because of the people, it says that he was sorrowful because of the separation of the Zoramites from the Nephites. And then it goes into a verse explaining the geography of where the Zoramites lived. And this is deliberate and important. It talks about how the Zoramites had gathered themselves together in the land which they called Antionum, which was east of the land of Zarahemla, which lay nearly bordering upon the seashore, which was south of the land of Jershon, which also bordered upon the wilderness south, which wilderness was full of the Lamanites. And that's a little bit convoluted, and there's a lot of steps there. And this is where it would be really helpful to have a visual component to the interpreter show, so we could show a map or something. But you get the idea. Verse 4 talks about how the Nephites greatly feared that the Zoramites would enter into a correspondence with the Lamanites, and that it would be a means of great loss on the part of the Nephites. And so what's important to know is where the land of Antionum and the land of the Zoramites is situated in relation to all the rest of the land. So if we think of the Book of Mormon lands-ish as an hourglass-ish shape, which is traditionally how it's often portrayed,
which shouldn't be that controversial, but is sometimes.
So we're thinking of it as an hourglass-ish. You know, you've got your narrow neck, and you've got the north and the land southward. The Nephites are in the land of Zarahemla, which is in the northern-ish part of this land southward. And then in the very south, you're going to have the Lamanites. And we don't know exactly where this took place in the Americas. We don't know exactly where how everything was positioned exactly. But we can get a general sense that the Nephites are north of the Lamanites, and the Zoramites are in the land of Antionum on an eastern coast, close to where the Lamanites are. And so if you can envision this, it's like the Zoramites are in kind of a no-man's land between the Nephites and the Lamanites. And sure enough, the Zoramites are showing signs of perverting the ways of the Lord and maybe taking an influence from their outside neighbors, which is dangerous not only religiously to keep the unity of the body of Christ, but also politically to keep the unity of the Nephite polity. If the Zoramites defect and enter into an alliance with the Lamanites, then all of a sudden it opens up a huge vulnerability in the Nephite polity to defend themselves. And so even though it's a political vulnerability and a political issue, the Nephites' answer to this isn't a political answer. They don't go in with armies. They don't go in with additional judges and lawyers and infrastructure to kind of bolster this. Instead, Alma decides the best response is a religious one. The best way to keep the unity of the Nephite people is to unify them spiritually and to unify them religiously. And I think that's a salient message for all of us today, that regardless of our political divisions, being unified in Christ and being unified under the gospel of Jesus Christ is a very powerful force to do good. And Alma even says so. And now, as the preaching of the word had a great tendency to lead the people to do that which was just, yea, it had had more powerful effect upon the minds of the people than the sword or anything else which had happened unto them. Therefore, Alma thought it was expedient that they should try the virtue of the word of God.
I think that if I can just jump in here really quick, I do think that that verse that Jasmine just read is, I think, a really important one. And it's as relevant today as it is any other, right? The message being that Alma understood that ultimately the only thing that was going to unite people, unify them, and bring that oneness that Jasmine was just talking about was not to compel them with violence. It was to convert them, right? To convert them to the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Because the alternative was potentially war and bloodshed for everyone.
Right, and this is a lesson I specifically think... I know I've gone back to the earliest chapters of Alma several times in this discussion, but I'm increasingly coming to realize that those early chapters lay the foundation for almost everything that happens, at least until Alma 45, when I think we technically have a new book starting, but because it becomes the Record of Human at that point. But... I think you got to go back to Alma 1, 2, and 3, and 4. That's when Alma kind of learns this lesson. Is he has the Amalekite rebellion that is this massive violent conflict with the sword, and the Nephites barely come out on top of that one, and he kills Amalekai, and it's shortly thereafter that Alma says, you know what, I'm out. I'm giving up the judgment seat. He appoints someone else to take his place. And he goes on a missionary trip. And he goes preaching. And some of the communities he specifically goes to, he goes to the land of Gideon, which connects back to the man that Nahor slew. And he goes to the land of Ammonihah, which is where the order of the Nahors, the people who supported Nahor, are. And it kind of seems to me what Alma is trying to do is he realizes that there is a big, big rift in their community. The Amalekites themselves were also of the order of the of Nahor. Alma is trying to take these communities that have been at odds with each other and reunite them under the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he's realized early in his career that the preaching of the word and conversion is the more powerful way rather than violent conflict and the sword.
As the old saying goes, if you want to change the world, engage the world of ideas, you know? And, you know, whenever you can affect someone else's belief in something, then you can start to affect their motives and their actions after that. That's why we talk so much about faith in Jesus Christ, because if you have faith in Jesus Christ, the natural actions will generally follow. If you actually believe that he has some sort of plan for you to access the power of his atonement and to change to become a different person, of course, you know, repentance will naturally follow from that. And from repentance, you get the first fruits of repentance being baptism, as Moroni tells us. And so, yeah, that, it's so important that we take the scriptures very seriously, especially informing our own ideas, and as we engage other people's ideas and help them to understand both the intellectual and the spiritual soundness of the gospel.
And then after that little introduction of who the Zoramites are and why they're a problem, then it describes in verse 7 how Alma took his A-team, his hashtag squad goals sons, on his Avengers Assemble mission.
So, someone needs to make a Book of Mormon movie about the A-team.
And he says that he took he didn't take his eldest son with him, but he took Shiblon and Corianton. And he also took Aaron and Ammon and Omner.
All the sons of Mosiah.
Except Himni. And he,
oh, that's right.
And also Amulek and Zeezrom.
I think that's everybody.
So he takes a bunch of people with him because this is an important mission. And so he brings his best game with him. And it talks about, okay, what exactly are the Zoramites doing that are perverting the ways of the Lord? First of all, they trampled Korhor. That's a no-no. Then the Zoramites, he talks about how they had fallen into grave errors and that they weren't following the statutes of the Lord according to the law of Moses. And then he outlines how they would not observe the performances of the church to continue in prayer and supplication to God daily. So there's some issues with worship going on, and they did pervert the ways of the Lord in many instances, and he doesn't elaborate on them. Therefore, Alma goes down to the land of Antionum. Now, does it already say Antionum, or do we get that name later? Well, anyway, the Zoramites are in the land of Antionum, and that name itself is kind of interesting because at least Stephen Rickson and Paul Hoskinson thinks it's comes from the word Antion, which we're introduced to in Alma 11 as a unit of currency for the Nephites. It's just kind of a little bit of a play on words there that this is the land of the money people, since the Zoramites themselves are notorious for being prideful and vain and lifted up in the riches of their hearts with their bracelets and their ringlets, and we'll listen more of that later. So there's a little bit of dramatic irony going on here with Antionum, the land of the Antion, the land of the silver and the money, being the land where the apostasy is. And then we get introduced to their worship practices. First, it describes where they worship, that they had built up in this, that they had built synagogues, and it was to their astonishment that they had built synagogues, to gather themselves together on one day of a week to worship, and in the center of the synagogue was a place for standing, which was high above the head and would only admit a person, and whoever wanted to worship would go and stand on the top thereof, stretch forth their hands, and cry with a loud voice, and then they give this rote prayer. And so there's a lot of interesting things about this, and I know either Stephen or Neil wrote a Noah about synagogues in Book of Mormon. That would be Stephen.
That was Stephen. Yes.
So I know the Nephites had synagogues. We see that name a lot in the Book of Mormon, but a lot of people assume that synagogues don't exist in Jewish religion until a lot later. So what do you say to that?
So the first thing, just to get out of the way, is what a synagogue means or what it is. Synagogue is actually a Greek word, and it basically is Greek for assembly or gathering. So it's a place where you get together with people, you know, basically. And it actually appears over 200 times in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, where it's used in different contexts. It can be used in like a military context, like a gathering of soldiers or a gathering of people of Israel. Typically, it's translated as quote congregation in English. The biblical equivalence to a synagogue in Greek would be an edda or a kahal, which both have the sense of like an assembly. A fun fact is that the Hebrew name for the book of Ecclesiastes is Kohelet, which is someone who gathers stuff, right? Like, because it's like a gathering of wisdom sayings or whatever. And when we think of synagogues today, we think of like modern synagogues that usually serve both obviously a religious function, but typically a community function as well, right? Anybody that's been to a synagogue knows that you can have community events and things like that, as well as religious services. So, yes, there people have wondered what are synagogues doing in the Book of Mormon, because supposedly they are anachronistic, speaking of anachronisms. And the short answer is we actually don't know exactly how far back synagogues go. To quote one scholar, quote, owing to the paucity of sources, opinions have varied widely as to when, where, and why the synagogue developed, end quote. However, there is some evidence that they do go back to the biblical period, perhaps even to the pre-exilic period, if you follow some arguments from some authorities. And probably the sort of the safer consensus these days is that what we think of as synagogue today originated more in the time of Jesus, but it had its roots in earlier institutions. For example, important community and religious events and services would happen at the city gates, for example, where you would have important members of the community come together and adjudicate legal issues or resolve religious disputes at little parts of the city gate, right? Like the little compartment or whatever that was built within the wall of the city. But that's just sort of the prevalent theory. That's still debated. Neil could probably say something, but there's some who think that the actual synagogue, as a fully fleshed out thing, actually is a pre-exilic thing. It's not just a city gate theory, but that we actually have pre-exilic synagogues.
Yeah, and that's all I was going to say or just add. I haven't done nearly as thorough a research as Stephen has on this, but you know, I've done a little reading and actually recently was doing some reading where it talked about exactly that. And I was actually kind of surprised. I had kind of always been under the impression that synagogue was a bit of a problem for the Book of Mormon. And I realized, well, actually, it just depends on which authorities you follow. As Stephen mentioned, there's a broad range of opinions because the historical origins are kind of murky. And among those opinions are some views that are entirely consistent with full-blown synagogues existing in Lehi's Jerusalem and being available as a model for his descendants to copy later.
Yeah.
Another possibility I think is maybe worth just kind of tossing out there is there certainly were public buildings and public spaces for public gathering in Mesoamerican city-states as well. The exact nature of them is different, obviously, and you do have the issue in the Book of Mormon that the phrase is sometimes, it specifically will say, synagogues after the manner of the Jews. But arguably, that could be either translation gloss, where, Joseph Smith as translator is assuming that, what he's translating is, the kind of synagogues they have is after the manner of the Jews, whereas it maybe was something they took from some of their Mesoamerican neighbors. It's also possible that it's an etiology for their own worship practices, right? They actually are things that progressed and developed within their own environment in Mesoamerica, but they kind of explained it as something that went back to their origins as Israelites. So,
Brent Gardner certainly seems to think that he is more in favor that the synagogue structure, as described in this chapter, would be following more after a Mesoamerican pattern than what we would typically assume as a Jewish synagogue as conceived in like the first century AD or later. In the synagogues that we see in late antiquity, it's a large-ish room with benches on the side that allow people to sit there, and then you're going to have a Torah shrine at the very front where the speaker would sit, and the Torah shrine is kind of a proxy for the temple that was destroyed in Jerusalem in 70 AD. And certainly in this point in history, before Christ even comes, we don't have any of that architectural patterns laid out. And Brent Gardner suggests that this is going to be a little bit more after a Mesoamerican model because it describes the architecture specifically that there was a place built up in the center of the synagogue for standing, which was high above the head and would only admit one person. And so he suggests that, well, if this is a stand that's going to be high above your head, it's got to be at least a two-story building. And that would have been pretty darn rare in the ancient world to have not just a two-story building, but a two-story height room. A room that was two stories tall would have been pretty darn rare in the ancient world. So he suggests that it might be an outdoor structure, that this is an open-air space. And then the stand in the middle probably has some sort of stairs. And so he suggests maybe it's a pyramidal structure.
Yeah, right.
Pyramidal, I don't know, a pyramid-like structure that is consisting of the grand system in this open-air space. So, just interesting thoughts.
That actually might tie in why Alma is so astonished that they're building synagogues, right? Is because they're building it in this Mesoamerican manner, as opposed to, because as Neil says, there's places where it says, we built synagogues after the manner of the Jews, which at its basic function just means that it worked the same way a Jewish synagogue worked, right? But if there's these syncretic Mesoamerican elements in there, then that would have been astounding, right, to these people that are seeing it for the first
time. I think there's a lot that's astounding about what Alma's beholding, and you can look at it from a bunch of different perspectives. Another thing to know is that Alma is speaking about the synagogues of the Zoramites in contrast to him establishing the church. And so I think when he talks about synagogues, he is talking about them as other, as separate from his order of religion.
To that point, real quick, I do want to point out, synagogue is used in the Book of Mormon predominantly, I think exclusively, to describe the physical place where people go to do worship services, whereas church is used in a more abstract sense of like they established the church in Zarahemla, not like the physical building, but like,
the people
coming together as sort of a thing. Or you have the Church of the Lamb of God and the Church of the Devil, right, in Nephi's vision. Like, these are sort of cosmological entities.
It's institutional or cosmological, yeah.
So, but interesting that, so both synagogue and church are Greek words. They basically mean the same thing.
This is Ecclesia, assembly.
This is looking in Joseph Smith's translation. So when you hear, well, there's synagogues in the Book of Mormon, there's churches in the Book of Mormon, that's not a problem. It basically means an assembly place, and they they change over time, as we've mentioned, even sometimes to the astonishment of Book of Mormon prophets themselves.
The
real question is what those included and what they expected from them and what they expected us to get from the Word, because this is a case where the authors of the Book of Mormon had access to a lot of context that we lack, and it puts us in a little bit of a difficult situation, as we often are when we're reading ancient documents, because if you don't know those things, it's very hard. It could be very hard to deduce them unless you have some sort of outside source to fill in the missing context, fill in the blanks for you.
Right. And the other thing that is astonishing is Alma explains how he was astonished at their apparel, because they had the ringlets and the bracelets, and they were caught up in the vain things of the world. And they were prideful, and the way that they were praying was prideful, because they seemed to be elect of God, and that we are saved out of everyone. And there's an interesting wordplay that Matt Bowen has pointed out with Ramiemptum is the name of the stand, and Ram, just like Zoram and the Zoramites, come from that Hebrew word Ram, which likely means to be exalted, to be high. And so it kind of plays with this thing of being prideful and haughty. And Alma, in his prayer at the end of the chapter, kind of plays on that they're lifted up in the pride of their hearts.
Well, and Bowen, and for those who want to look it up, the Matt Bowen paper that Jasmine is talking about is on the Interpreter website, so you can check it out there. But Bowen argues specifically that the name Zoram means he who is exalted, or the exalted one. And so Zoramites would be the exalted ones, right? They're very, it's a very appropriate name for a people who kind of broke off and think, you know, hey, we're really special and we're going to stand on this really high Ramiemptum, and we're gonna talk about how we're so special and chosen, and everybody else just doesn't know what's going on in the world. So anyway, it's an interesting paper. I really like it. You might find my name in a footnote in there. I don't know.
Final thoughts, just a minute or two left.
I'll just point out that one of the apostate Zoramite beliefs is that God is a spirit. which I don't know, says some interesting things about the supposed a primitive theology of the Book of Mormon that people like to talk about, right?
Sure.
Oh man, I could go on for a couple hours about that, you know, just on how silly I think the idea is in general, you know. I don't know. We already have Ether talking about how Jesus is like an embodied spirit.
Precisely.
You know? And I mean, you have the Jaredite records that the Nephites are supposedly in possession of, as they're talking about Christ as a spirit, but not some sort of like. I mean, the Nephites are clearly saying, no, you can't believe that he's just like some ethereal, like immaterial essence. He's like he's got a body, because we got these records from the Jaredites, you know. So it just kind of.
All right. Well, if nobody else has anything to say, I think we'll just wrap the show up at this point. This has been the Interpreter Show. My name is Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley, Spencer Marsh, for the last time, Stephen Smoot. Next time we hear from him, hopefully it'll be Dr. Stephen Smoot,
yes.
As opposed to Master Smoot, as he is.
When people ask me for my name and I say Stephen, and they say, is that Stephen with a V or Stephen with a PH? I can say, actually, it's Stephen with a PhD.
Nice.
That's what I'm looking forward to. That's the whole reason
but
I'm going into this, just so I can use that joke.
And then joining us here on phone is the already Dr. Hale Swift, the PhD here. Thank you guys for listening. We've been covering the Come Follow Me lesson for Alma 30 and 31, and we hope you enjoyed it, and have a good rest of your Sunday evening.